Tim is testing now. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm drinking a fake Le Croix.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for March 2019. I am your host, Jonathan Butcher, and I'm joined once again by the no longer disabled Tim Nelson. Because, of course, last time we got together, Tim, you sacrificed your body on behalf of our podcast. You hobbled into a showing of If Beale Street Could Talk when you probably should have gone to the hospital, and we are eternally grateful. But now, 2 months later, your leg is healed. How are you feeling?
I'm all right, man. Nice. Except, you know what? I was so excited because I looked at my new insurance card.
Okay.
Because I went right after If Beale Street Could
you
Talk.
Did. You
I went
literally,
to the ER.
He sent me a picture. That is a true story.
Yeah, it's true. I went to the ER. Got x-rayed. It turned out I didn't break anything, but there's some problems still. But here's what I learned, that I was really pumped because I looked like I didn't have a copay anymore for the ER. The reality is I didn't have a copay for the ER because now I had to pay 40%.
Oh, so you were really excited and then reality set in.
It didn't work. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that has to do with anything, but it made me mad.
Yeah, I bet it did. Yeah. Well, I think everyone's in agreement that we have a fantastic healthcare system, so at least you can feel good about
that. I thought so. I benefit directly from it, so yes.
All right. Well, a lot's happened since we talked, Tim. The most important thing, of course, being the Oscars.
Oh, yes.
Now, before we dive into the big night, and don't worry, we will. I know it's been a really long time since we've actually talked to each other, so I did want to leave a little space. Have you been watching anything? Has there been anything that's like been...
gripping me?
Yes, gripping
you. Have me in its evil grasp?
Yeah.
You know, I've been watching a lot of fishing shows. I'm like,
oh, no.
Yeah, so those don't really count.
This doesn't even count as anything. It's not TV or movies. There's no story. You're literally just watching fishing videos.
That's true.
My gosh.
It's not probably healthy, but no. Actually, I did see a movie.
Okay.
Junebug. Have you seen
Love Junebug. Yes.
YOLO Tango is the, or YOLO Tango. I can't remember the band, but it's one of my friend's bands that he loved from the 90s.
Uh-huh.
So that movie, and it's Amy Adams,
Amy
right?
Adams, and probably what could still be her best performance. She should have gotten an Oscar for that.
She got nominated.
She got nominated, but there's this whole thing about like she's been nominated like 6 times. That should have won her an Oscar. Like she is fantastic in that film. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I thought that was an interesting film about that, like that kind of like small town dynamics.
Yes.
What's family look like and how are we bankrupt here in the city versus, you know, in a country, in a place where family matters and
It's a very touching movie.
Yeah, so I saw that. I thought that was pretty decent. I just hadn't seen it before. Mm-hmm. It's something I would like have paid money in the theater to see probably.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should have. But
I think just, it's worth seeing just for Amy Adams.
Reminded me a little of, I think it's that Cameron Crowe movie about Kentucky or something.
One of his good ones or bad ones? There was that awful one with Orlando Bloom, which I don't like talking about. Elizabethtown.
Elizabethtown.
That is what you're talking about.
Okay. It is.
Yeah,
so it reminded me a little bit of that.
I'm sorry.
But whatever.
Cameron Crowe used to be a great director. I will stand by Jerry Maguire and Almost Famous till my dying day, but then I don't know what happened. Elizabethtown, We Bought a Zoo. Ugh.
I didn't realize. All right, so you can see our Almost Famous podcast from several years ago.
Absolutely.
And you can get all of John's thoughts on Cameron Crowe.
So while Tim has been watching fishing videos, I have still been sticking in the realm of narrative, although it has been television, and I just have to say, I have been more impressed than even I have been over the quality of television on Netflix, Amazon, HBO, you name it. We are in a season to remember when it comes to television. So my wife and I are going through second season of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I know you watched the first season. I don't know if you guys watched the second season.
I started it on the second and I just got tired.
It's even better than the first season. It's so good. It is. It is. And so we've paired that actually with a broadcast show, The Good Place, which I usually avoid broadcast shows because, you know, it seems like every single one of them is some other variation of Law and Order or CSI and blah, right? But like The Good Place is actually an extremely clever show. It's very like subversive and it's very witty. It's from the same dude who did like The Office and everything. So I guess I should have known. But
Gervais?
Yeah. No. Michael Skur. He did The Office and a bunch of other things. But anyway, so I mean, that's our 1-2 punch that I do with my wife. And then on the side, because my wife can't stand like, you know, drama and like really heavy stuff, I do all the dark stuff on the side. So I've been taking in like season 3 of True Detective with Mahershala Ali, which is so good on HBO, Tim. It's literally this detective story told in 3 different parts of this guy's life. Like when he's like in his 20s, when he's in like his 40s, and then when he's like an actual senior citizen with dementia. And it goes back all crisscrossing throughout all these 3 stages told. And you're unraveling this mystery, and it is so good. You've got to see it.
Wow.
Yes. And finally, I finished that, and I jumped on board back to Netflix to watch Narcos Mexico, which I was very skeptical about because I loved the first 3 seasons of Narcos. And in fact, the 3rd season was like one of the best seasons of television I've ever seen. It was that good. And I'm like, why are they starting over with like a brand new almost iteration of it with this whole Mexico thing? But it is just as good as the original Narcos. You got Michael Pena in a dramatic role, which is awesome to see. He's always like the funny sidekick. And you've got this hero and villain on like competing tracks but they're very similar. And it's just the great thing about Narcos is it's kind of like The Wire, where you see the good guys and you see the bad guys and everything, and you somehow want both to succeed, even though that's like impossible
because they're very, you know, similar, probably, like they yes. have desires and the humanity to them,
exactly,
and they're working really hard to get something.
Yeah,
and they're not that different. Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, so it's great. So I'm just so blown away by television, and truly we're living in a golden era. And then you've got the last season of Game of Thrones is coming out next month, which is the capper. So I know that we're a movie podcast, and I am sorry if there's any diehards out there who are like, really, like, do we have to do television again? But I just think it's worth mentioning Dan and I made a promise that we would not feature television on the website, so as, in his words, to not, quote, dilute our brand. We don't feature any articles or anything like that on the website. This is my only chance publicly to talk about good television. I just have to put in the
You've been repressed. Yeah. For some, apparently, I don't keep...
You're not keeping
I on. Don't keep a very tight ship compared to Dan. Go ahead, man. Dilute the brand.
You're saying you should be more aggressive on this podcast. You should shut it down if you want to.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. We need more straight whiskey and less your water, right?
I love it. All right. Well, we'll see about that in the upcoming year. All right, Tim, it's time. The Oscars. Now, we were all really sad that you cannot join us for our live tweeting event. I know there are a lot of listeners out there who are looking forward to having you on board. We miss your quick wit, but you were taking care of yourself, and yes. you were burning the candle at both ends. You had so much going on. I totally understand. You just needed a night by yourself, and I completely understand that. And so congratulations to you for taking care of yourself and tapping out for some self-care. But we did miss you, and I hope that maybe next year you'll be back.
Well, I had intended to be there, but I was I just burned out, basically.
Totally, yeah.
And I ended up watching half of it on my couch.
Yeah.
You know, quietly to myself.
Absolutely.
But I did get fired up.
You did.
At certain points.
We did
And I did text you.
A fiery text exchange at one point.
Yes.
Yes. So hopefully next year you can join us, but...
Oh, you know what I'm going to wear next year?
What?
I had to buy a tuxedo for an event for my wife's work, so I will show up in a tux next year, I promise you.
Pictures will be on social media.
Yeah, I will show up in a full... I will look excellent.
Well, I was the only one who dressed up at our Oscar party.
Are you serious?
The only one.
No, I'm going to have a tuxedo, man, a wool tuxedo.
Awesome. Yeah. Can't wait. So, the Oscars. Now, I know you only saw half, but let's get into what we can. First of all, I think the Oscars were better without a host. Do you agree?
I like the missteps of the hosts.
You do? Okay, so that's an element you like.
I think that's entertaining. I like the cheesy writing. I like when people can come up with stuff on their feet. Now, of course, there's for every good host, there's 2 bad ones.
Yeah.
So I like that.
Okay.
But I don't think it's like an essential.
I just thought it flowed surprisingly better, right? Because when you have a comic host, there's just kind of this, I feel like they feel they need to get on the pages of the newspaper the next morning, so they need to do this kind of zany stuff. And it eventually just starts to peter out and gets old. Whereas this, by not having one, you can just keep throwing fresh people on stage and it just never got old. And I just felt like it flowed better. But I know what you're saying.
I think we should next year have a host and then not show the best cinematography awards. Oscar.
Gosh.
That's how I feel.
I'm so glad they brought that back. They were going to literally show in commercials cinematography, and there was like 3 other categories, and then there was protest by Everyone.
Yeah.
And they brought it back.
They've lost their minds. It makes you like wonder about like the Oscars themselves when they make choices like that.
Well, there's this like this belief among the producers every year where it's like, we've got to keep things shorter, like because we've got to attract. It's like, who are you trying to attract? The people who watch the Oscars do not care that it's really long. That's why we're watching the Oscars.
Super Bowl. Nobody cares.
Yeah, they take
like a, what, how many minutes of game? 60 minutes of game and turn it into 5 hours.
Yes. The most boring Super Bowl ever. Millions of people still tuned in. It's fine.
Right. And so for me, I think, you know, I don't want it to be 5 hours, but I don't mind if it's 3 or 4.
No.
Honestly.
Exactly. So I'm glad they brought that back. All right. So as far as the night itself, there were definitely some things that were expected going in that happened. Mahershala Ali was expected to win. He won. But there were some really big surprises. Like Olivia Colman won for the favorite instead of Glenn Close, who people thought was like a shoo-in for the wife. So that was a shocker. Now, you saw the favorite. But you probably didn't see the wife yet, right?
No, I haven't seen the wife yet.
Okay. She was really good in the wife, Glenn Close. And I kind of understand the whole, like, she's in actress who's done tons of movies and this would be her first Oscar, so I get the kind of the legacy aspect of it, but I was totally fine with Olivia Colman winning because she was really good in the favorite.
My wife and I saw the favorite on a date.
You did?
Yeah.
That's the worst date movie ever.
It's pretty weird. But like, yeah, so I thought that was good too. Like, I totally agree with it. I thought she was brilliant.
She was.
She's the, you know, well, there was like, and there was so much good acting in that movie.
Yes, absolutely. And then Rami Malek came through for Bohemian Rhapsody, despite Christian Bale being the favorite for Vice. So you did tell me you saw Bohemian Rhapsody, and you appeared to like it more than I did. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a good movie.
Okay.
I do think I agree with your, that the last part of it is like this like fandom.
Self-indulgent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's you know, very biography, so there's not actually a lot of, it's hard to find the story in the story.
Yeah.
And that's okay with me.
You agree with then my kind of B-ish take of it? I would go like a B, but
okay. I don't think it's an Oscar contender. Yes, it had good cinematography. Yes, it had good sound, good performances, but I don't think of it as anything like so exceptional that it could beat out some of this competition.
It started winning all these technical awards early in the night, like best editing, which is just mind-boggling to me, and I started getting really worried that like Bohemian Rhapsody is going to win everything, but thankfully it did not. Although what did end up winning Best Picture might have been just as problematic, and that was of course Green Book. Green Book won Best Picture, and it won it very shortly after Spike Lee won for BlacKkKlansman. So the juxtaposition of those two wins is, I think, says a lot about why people are upset about Green Book winning. There's a great episode of The Daily podcast that lays out this from a black film critic's perspective. His name's Wesley Morris, and he basically points out that it was actually 30 years ago that Driving Miss Daisy won Best Picture, and that was the same year that Do the Right Thing, like Spike Lee's magnum opus on race relations.
Did we podcast on Do the Right Thing?
Yes.
So if you want to know what we think about that,
yes,
go into the archives and you'll hear us like rant about it.
Totally.
But it is the same thing.
Yes.
So
Do the Right Thing wasn't even nominated, and then you have Driving Miss Daisy winning Best Picture. And so then 30 years later, you have this other movie about two people from different races driving in a car together and, you know, overcoming all their differences and living happily ever after, and then it wins Best Picture in the same year that BlacKkKlansman is up. Now, I would say that Green Book is a good movie. You probably, have you seen Green Book yet?
No, because they're holding it hostage. I have to either buy it for like 20 bucks.
I know.
Or go to the theater, find like the one theater that still has it.
I hate it when Amazon does it. And I always fall for it too, because I start to go, well, if I was seeing it in the theater.
I'm not going to buy it I would rent it.
Yeah.
But like, it's like part of my, yeah.
So I think it's a good movie, but part of what Wesley Morris was arguing is that the fact that it actually is well made is part of the problem, because it overshadows the fact that its treatment of race is so banal and simplistic. This idea that if we just sat long enough in a car together, you know, everything would be fine and we could overcome lifelong prejudice, right, is so ridiculous. And so the fact that it is actually well made by Peter Farrelly kind of smothers over that. And so I think that's a lot of people are upset. But you were upset. You texted me. What are your thoughts on Green Book?
So I think it's like a white person's version of racial reconciliation, which is that would happen one-on-one. and that one-on-one racial reconciliation would kind of happen privately. Well, Spike Lee uses the term the magical Negro, right? So basically there's a white man that needs something.
Yes.
And that there is a character that exists solely to give that white person some new understanding or give that white person the key to their character development.
Mm-hmm.
But that they themselves are not actually the main character at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's the case because I haven't seen this movie, but you could tell me if you feel like, did that have that element to it?
Totally the case. The movie is told from Tony Lip's perspective, from Viggo Mortensen's perspective. And it could have been told from Dr. Shirley's perspective, who Mahershala Ali played that character. It could have been told from him. But from the beginning, this is all about Tony Lip. And just like Morgan Freeman with Mrs. Daisy, basically the black character is arguably a prop to sort of help the white person in their journey of self-discovery. And it's a legitimate criticism.
Right.
Absolutely.
So I think, so that's like that's a white idea of racial, so that it would be that the reconciliation wouldn't be systematic. It wouldn't mm-hmm. be so deeply ingrained that it would just be simply, oh, you should make some better choices, or yep. you should change the way you view things,
yep.
or maybe, you know, you're not understanding people. Yeah, but I mean like individuals.
Yeah.
But that would come individually. I think that's a very white idea.
And the Academy is still, let's face it, made up of primarily older white voters. That's just the reality of the situation. And it has been getting more diverse. I'm grateful for that. You know, there have been movements of Oscars so white a few years ago and this push for diversity. So more than ever before, the Oscar Academy is growing to become more diverse. But as of right this moment, Green Book is sort of the effect of the predominant demographic in the Academy.
So I was reading some stuff about the family of the, because I couldn't see it, but I read a bunch of stuff online.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to spend, you know, $20.
Right.
And so I read some stuff online though, because I was really interested. And it was looking like the family didn't approve of the portrayal, but also that the very reason why this class is a classical pianist or something. Mm-hmm. What was he? Is that what he was?
Yeah. He was a professional pianist. Yeah.
And like the very reason that he intentionally hired a white driver was to basically, you know, give the middle finger to people. I mean, as he was traveling.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, like, that was the interpretation of his family. It was like, no, he did this very purposefully. And it was like,
it's not the movie's perspective at all.
Right. The movie's perspective is
he needed this muscular bodyguard to basically, if the case there was any trouble.
And,
right.
Yeah. And the family perspective, and I don't know how accurate it is, but I mean, where else are you going to get your data, right? The family perspective was like, no, he did this quite intentionally to send a message.
Wow. And the family also argues that they weren't close friends, that it was always a very employer-employee relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is like a fabrication.
Yeah.
That's a little troubling.
It is. Their concerns are really troubling. And the fact that they're the best excuse the filmmakers have come up with is, oh, we didn't know they were still alive. I mean, it's just, do a little research.
Wait, they didn't know he had any family?
Yeah. They literally said, we didn't know. And then, you know, okay. So let's just give
like,
them...
Are they like developing this film from a Wikipedia article?
It sounds like
they didn't do any research whatsoever.
Well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and let's say that's true. For whatever reason, they're living in a bubble. They don't know the family exists. You still have a perfect opportunity after the fact to apologize, to try to make things right. But instead, what we saw on Oscar night was Peter Farrelly did not mention the family or the controversy once during the whole night in his acceptance speeches. And then in his Best Picture acceptance speech, actually said, looked at Viggo Mortensen and said point blank, this movie would not have existed without Viggo Mortensen. Let's all remember that. Like, I mean, that was just like a slap to the face. Like, you have not been paying attention, dude. Right? Unbelievable.
So this is the same guy that gave us like the something about
this
Mary.
This is the same. Like... Yes. Again, good filmmaker, and Green Book is a good movie, but underneath the surface, there are some majorly troubling details. Yes. All right. But overall, yeah, I think it was a good Oscar night. The show flowed, ups and downs. But I think beyond the Oscars, we have to recognize, since this is kind of our last chance to talk about 2018, that it was a great year for movies.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, better than last year.
Yeah, we were talking about it at the beginning of the year that it just felt like something fresh was in the air. And I feel like when I compare my top 10 this year to last year, this year schools it. So I think we had a really good year.
Roma should have had Best Picture.
Hey, say. Yes.
I really do think that.
Dude, I'm with you. And your Alfonso Cuarón had a good night, though. All right? I mean, he won Best...
So here's my question. Yeah. How many times can our Mexican directors get Best Director and not get Best Picture?
Yeah.
Like, it's beginning to, like, seem to me that that we just can't.
Well, Guillermo del Toro did get Shape of Water last year.
He did. He did. But which, like, look at Inarritu.
Yeah.
He get, what did he get? Best Director twice, but didn't get Best Picture? Is
that's
that right?
Right. Well, Birdman won. The Revenant did not
win. The Revenant did not win. Yeah. Okay, so he didn't win, but that was two. Yeah. Was that like back to back?
Yeah. He had a really good stretch. And then he like has taken a vacation for the last like 2 years. You had never heard of him.
He made. Yeah. So, but like, I think there's this like hesitance to like give the Mexican directors because they're dominant.
Yeah.
They're killing
they're
it.
They're schooling
man.
It, man. Look at them.
I mean, there's like what? One film in the last how many years that wasn't a Mexican best director?
Gosh, you're right. I mean, if you look at the last 5 years, they are killing the competition when it comes to best director, and I'm with you. But I do still think it's cool that he won best cinematography, especially with that whole Emmanuel Lubezki was going to do it, then he dropped out at the last minute, and then this the first time he goes behind the lens, he wins best cinematography. I think that's amazing.
And what he says, like, just do it. I just thought to myself, what would Lubezki do? I'm like, dang, I wish I could even have a thought like that.
No kidding.
But
and Lubezki's our boy, so this is good stuff.
It was cool. It was like old school. Everybody's like, hey, this looks like old like Italian, you know, stuff from the 50s.
That was my first impression of Roma, was that it really felt like in like you're watching something that's a classic, you know, like, and it came
it's
out
not just
this
the black
year.
it's not the black and white, because yeah. You can watch other ones like The Artist or mm-hmm. Which did The Artist win Best Picture? I think it did. Mm-hmm. But you look at those and they're not a classic just because they're in black and white. This was like more, it was the cinematography. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just that the film stock was this certain, it was black and white. It was that the shots were very classic. I mean, it's like basically they're all paintings.
Yep. It feels like something your film professor would put on day one and be like, all right,
we're gonna
here we go.
Break this apart.
Yeah. And it probably will be that for years to come. So Roma is a great movie. I totally would have been fine with it winning Best Picture. It was either going to be Roma for me or The Favorite, and either one would have been fine for me. So I'm glad it got some things, but you're right. Roma was a fantastic film. Oh, and thank you. Speaking of which, I did want to say real quick that I have to take something back because we spent a lot of time going over Roma, and I spent a lot of time saying that, look, I don't have a straight A movie this year, right? My top few movies are all A minuses, but I actually went back. I rewatched The Favorite. I rewatched Roma, both of them. And I will say that both of those movies are perfect in my mind. The rewatch for both of them convinced me that they're perfect films. And I would like to personally apologize to you for Roma because we spent like 45 minutes talking about how it's not a truly great, great film. I take it all back. I was blown away by my second viewing of Roma. And I totally got what you were saying about how the fact that I want this whole, like, you know, big moment to happen is the whole freaking point of the movie. And it, like, all of your lines were coming back to haunt me when I watched it the second time. So
that's all right.
You were right. Let the record show.
It took a lot for me to be right about that. So I really appreciate that you saw my hard work.
Absolutely. All right. So now it's time to transition. We've covered the Oscars. We've talked about how great 2018
was. Oh, I was right, by the way, about the documentary. You should mention that.
What? Oh, Free Solo. We tweeted this on Oscar night, but let it be known that Tim, during our podcast, thought that Free Solo was a better documentary than the Mr. Rogers doc. And as it turned out, the Mr. Rogers doc wasn't even nominated. Free Solo was, and it ended up winning Best Freaking Documentary.
I know.
Boom.
It's good. It was pretty innovative.
Tim, you've had quite a good year.
A good year. I wish I would, like, I just need to keep predicting things.
Yeah.
Well, it helps that the Academy is a bunch of old white guys, because that's apparently what I am.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Yes. So well done. All right. So we've covered that. We're ready to turn the page on this podcast, and we are going to do that today by talking about a really, really old movie. So yes, I'm sorry to everyone who was hoping that we might actually cover our first film from 2019, but we are not quite ready to go there yet. Possibly next time. Hopefully, I'm going to make every effort possible to actually review a brand new 2019 movie, but this time around, we are going to step back in time for a few reasons. One, it's a wasteland in movie theaters right now, people. There's just garbage playing on every screen in America.
What garbage are you speaking of,
it's
John?
So bad. I don't want to.
What filth? What dripping?
It's so bad. I've heard that the new Captain Marvel is not good.
It's making money.
It's making tons of money, but even Dan said it was a very mediocre film.
But in America, if it's making lots of money, it must be good.
So there's that, and there's just a bunch of other stuff that just looks absolutely atrocious. And so, look, we can't, there's nothing in theaters. And then secondly, the movie we're going to be talking about actually has an Oscar connection. So there's a little bit of a significance to what we're covering, right?
Ah, yes.
Yes, yes. So it's related there. And three, frankly, we've just been really, really busy, and watching something from the comfort of our couch sounded like the best.
It was the best option.
The best option at our current juncture.
Yeah, it's that time of year, and I bet you feel that way too.
Oh, totally. I've been avoiding the movie theater like the plague.
Yeah. It's like, you know, there's right. only so much. It, when it starts losing the magic, you need to take a break a little bit.
Take a big break.
And then when you come back again, you can go, oh, this is why we go to the movies.
100%. So we are going to go back a long way in film history to the year 1950, and we're going to discuss Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon.
Yes.
That is what we're talking about. Rashomon is our main topic for the month. So let's get into it. And I have to begin with a confession, Tim.
Yes.
I love movies.
Yes, John.
But I have a problem. I really don't. It's not that I don't like old movies. It's that I would never on my own watch them. And I think that is the confession I'm trying to make, is that on a Saturday night, I'm rifling through what should I watch, I'm never going to go back and say, I want to watch a movie from 1950. It's just never going to happen. I know all the big classics, you know, like the Citizen Kane, Jaws, 2001, all the big ones, but just diving that far in film history really is not my cup of tea, and I'm sorry. But when I do go back, usually because I'm forced, I do enjoy pretty much every movie that I see. So that's my confession.
And do you realize like everything you're watching now is derivative of those films?
Yes. Oh, Quentin Tarantino stole it directly from that film.
Yeah, that's now you see it, right? yeah, totally.
Yes. So that's my confession. I'm not an old movie person. I would almost give myself expert knowledge from, say, the year 1990 on, but when you start going back really far, I start losing the thread. I actually watched my first Alfred Hitchcock movie like 3 months ago. I know that is...
How have we not reviewed a Hitchcock movie?
I know, we haven't. I watched North by Northwest.
Yes.
It was amazing.
We'll have to have Ben on for that because that's his favorite director.
Yes. So Tim, I'm going to be relying on you a little more than usual here because you actually on a Saturday night do go back and watch really old movies. And so I'm going to need your expertise on this.
So I'm not like some expert on Kurosawa. I watch a lot of Kurosawa movies, but it's been a while.
Well, what would you say, why does Kurosawa matter? Why is he important to film history? What would you say?
He established post-war Japanese film internationally. So I would say that, and with the film we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's the first part. I would say he matters because of his influence. The spaghetti Western basically owes itself, well, actually most of the Westerns owe Kurosawa this great debt.
Hmm. I'm not talking about like Clint Eastwood type stuff.
Clint Eastwood. So anywhere from Fistful of Dollars for a few dollars more, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the Magnificent Seven, like Seven Samurai. That's totally just stolen, lifted, man. But I think Yojimbo is Fistful of Dollars.
Okay.
So like basically these movies, like the plots are like directly stolen from him.
He paved the way.
Yeah, so he has all this like wonderful screenwriting in some ways. I mean, he has good cinematography. Some of the editing's sloppy, but a lot of the technique is really good.
His writing is phenomenal. I was just marveling. Now, I don't know how much it's definitely Japanese movie and English subtitles, so it's hard to know exactly how this sounds if you actually spoke Japanese. But just even reading the subtitles, I'm like, wow, that is a profound line. Like, he's a really good writer. Yeah
so like well thought out. And I think that because he was mentored by a guy that emphasized, if you want to be a good director, you also have to know good screenwriting. Mm. What ended up happening is he did write a lot, but he also ended up going, I need to have the best screenwriters in Japan or I can't be the best director.
Wow, okay.
And so he ends up finding these great screenwriters and having them not always just come up with original material, but adapt things. And then he was widely read. So he read Shakespeare. He read just a whole bunch of different literature that was outside of his context, mm-hmm. and was able to adapt things. Like some of his films are like adaptations of Shakespeare, and he read all kinds of different literature and poetry that were outside of, like, they weren't Japanese, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So he's kind of international in the way he thinks. In fact, he was rejected at one point by a lot of the main culture in Japan, like of directors and stuff, were kind of rejecting him as being not Japanese enough.
Too modern, right? Well, if you're lifting Shakespeare, I could see. This is actually my first Kurosawa movie that I've ever seen. So I was texting Tim because he was like, we got to do Kurosawa, because he knew that I hadn't seen anything. And I was like, where do we start? And this was where he suggested we
start.
Well,
I said Seven Samurai.
You did. You did.
And I said, do you have 3.5 hours? And you're like, oh.
I did grimace at that, yes. I was like, okay, I could, I guess, watch a little bit, you know, Friday, Saturday.
I own it.
Yeah, you do? Okay.
Yeah, so if you want to watch it, I got it here. That will never happen.
But anyway.
I would love to watch it like 10. My kid got through about 2 hours and tapped out.
You showed it to your kid?
Yeah, it's samurai's fighting.
Holy cow.
Kind of cool.
I've heard nothing but good things about it, and I definitely will watch it some other time when you force me to. But
the movie Three Amigos is based on Seven Samurai.
No way. Chevy Chase, Martin Short, that Three Amigos?
Yes. It's the same plot.
Do you have anything else here besides Mexican food?
That's the one. The very one. So basically the plot is of this poor villagers that have nothing to offer.
Yeah.
Go in search of these great defender warriors that can save them from bandits that keep raiding the village.
Three Amigos was such an original concept.
No, it's exactly. It's just the same plot. And that plot's everywhere. Like every Western is that plot.
Mm-hmm. Jeez. So, all right, Rashomon. So that's the one we landed on, mostly, I think, because Tim had mercy on me and it's only 88 minutes. But still,
But it was like he broke on the scene with us.
Yeah, I saw this film and I loved it, as I have everything that Tim has shown me. Tim showed me The Bicycle Thief once, which I don't know. Is that, when is that? 60s?
No, it was similar time period.
Okay, around the 50s. That was a great film. Again, love old movies when I actually watch them. But so I watched this and I really enjoyed it.
You didn't like On the Waterfront.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't like On the Waterfront because it felt very dated. It was kind of like
heavy-handed.
Yeah,
like, yeah. Okay. All right.
Sorry. It's okay. Marlon Brando is still cool. But so I want to outline the plot here just for a bit of context, since I might not be the only one who's never seen this movie. So this is a Japanese movie with English subtitles, came out in 1950, and it's basically a story told from multiple perspectives, which doesn't seem particularly revolutionary now, but apparently back then this was kind of the first of its kind, where you tell the same story from different angles, right?
Yep.
And so you have these citizens of a village that are kind of gathered together in this old fortress-looking place called Rashomon, and they're gathered there because it's raining, like it is pouring raining, okay? And they're just like trying to get away from the rain, and they're sitting around.
Yeah. So I found this out. I didn't know this. I'd watched this, like, this is my third time watching it. The Rashomon's actually a gate.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's this grandiose gate. Now, here's why it's significant. People would abandon their infants there. And then people come by and they pick up the infants.
That ties into the ending.
Yes, it does. Okay. But anyway, go ahead.
That makes so much more sense. Okay, so you have these three characters, particularly in the script, they're actually called the priest, the woodcutter, and the commoner, okay? And they converge under this shelter because it's pouring rain. And the commoner overhears the priest and this woodcutter talking about this incident that they were like partial witnesses to, which involved this bandit attacking this couple as they were just traveling. They were just walking along a road traveling, and this bandit attacked them. And what you end up seeing in this movie is four different angles of this story, of this bandit attacking this couple on the road. First, you hear it told by the bandit's version, like his version of the story. No, the bandit.
Oh, you're right. Because the woodcutter just says he, like, I just found a body.
Yeah.
Or is that the commoner? No, that's the woodcutter.
Yes. So basically, the woodcutter and the priest were actually at this trial that they had for this murder that took place because the husband was murdered. And so you hear the testimony and see kind of the testimony play out of the bandit's version. Then you hear the wife's version of the couple that was attacked. Then you hear the dead husband's version through a medium, which turns out to be his wife, somehow can summon her husband's dead spirit back to tell his version of events. And then finally you actually have the woodcutter, because he witnessed partially the actual incident happen. So four different angles, and all of them are really, really different from each other, and that's what makes the movie interesting. So that's the movie in a nutshell. It's kind of simple and complex at the same time, because on the one hand it's the same story, but on the other hand you have so many different angles of the incident, and you have no idea which one is right. And I don't even think Kurosawa cares that much or wants us to care that much about like what actually happened. I feel like it's not about unraveling the mystery. It's more about diving into human nature, right, through these four different angles. And so we're going to dive into that theme. But first, from a technical standpoint, Tim, can you just enlighten us? What makes Rashomon groundbreaking just technically in the scope of film history? Is there any, what about it was like,
well,
whoa?
A few of the things that it does that are pretty sophisticated is that the cinematography and some of the shots mirror the content. he only has basically money for three locations, and they're all terrible, right? Because they don't cost anything, really.
Yeah.
I guess probably the gate is probably the most expensive one, but he basically has the content mirror the sky. So the idea being that when there's sunlight in the shots, that might be true. That's truth, right? A clear sky is truth. When it's raining or cloudy or the leaves are in the way of the sun, the idea is that the truth is being obscured.
Whoa.
In some kind of way. So
I'm trying to think back to my viewing of it now. That changes a lot of things. I wish I had known that up front.
So the forest where everything happens, you get partial truth all the time, except there's a few places in the forest and some of the shots where it's full sunlight.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. Trippy, right? I know. He's like a master. I know.
Yeah.
Also, it's raining on the at the gate for the most of the time, and they're taking shelter in this like gate that basically has been destroyed.
But it's clear skies during the trial scenes.
But that, yeah, and there's clear skies in the trial. The idea is like they're trying to find out what the truth is.
Okay.
And they're getting like all these versions of the truth.
Right.
He emphasizes the fact that it's impossible to find the truth during the whole storytelling at the gate with heavy rain. In fact, he had to dye the rain black.
Oh.
For the camera to pick up on it. Otherwise, it was just too clear because it's like this heavy rain that's drenching them. They're taking shelter at the city gate because it's the only place that they won't get soaking wet. So they build a little fire.
He dyed the rain black.
He dyed it black. So and they pump the stuff, you know.
That's so cool.
They trick because it wasn't picking it up on the film stock.
Yeah.
But the idea is that element, you know, we just think, oh, weather, whatever. That element like was saying, no, this is obscured. This is not clear. The sunlight is not able to come down. The idea of that truth is not able to be known.
Mm.
And then there would be brief periods of time where things would be totally true. And then a lot of times it would be a mix of truth and unknowing.
Yep.
And so he does that with the actual cinematography, not just the storyline.
That's right. That's the sign of a true auteur. We talked about mise en scène before, you know, where every element is not just there. It's not like, oh, it's cool to have rain right now. It's like it means something. That's when you're in the hands of a master. Yeah.
So everything about the film is that way, from even the length of shots. So, you know, I was reading that he would give equal length of shots to people within Rashomon, like each different person.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was like, yeah. But like, I think that's like just, it's kind of like a level that we're not used to of that kind of level of detail. And especially in 1950.
Yeah, no kidding. So. Well, as a Kurosawa newbie, I definitely felt like he had very assured style to his approach, right? Like even in the beginning, and I was thinking about this later, so I could be wrong, but I don't think they showed Rashomon as the title in the opening credit, big long opening credit sequence. I think he actually waited until they kind of set the stage of the story and then they panned up to the sign,
sign
above
the
gate that said Rashomon. I think that's great. I even in modern movies, I think it's really cool when you wait for the title to kind of be a punch a little bit into the story after you've sort of set the scene. Yeah. I think that's really cool. And so he did that all the way back in 1950. And he has the boldness to build up in like the story really hard at the beginning. Like all the beginning is a bunch of guys saying, I've heard something that you'll never believe. You're not going to believe this story. Like I can't even describe it. And it's just like building up the hype of it. And I just think it takes some boldness to do that and then tell your story and have it actually live up to the hype. One modern day example of that is Seven, the film by David Fincher. If you go back and you watch that, the ending, like they keep building up this ending, right? Morgan Freeman actually says to Brad Pitt, he's like, dude, this ending is never going to live up to our expectations. If like aliens start flying out of John Doe's head, like it's not going to live up to our expectations. They just keep building and building. And then the ending actually ends up being an amazing punch in the gut, like everything you could have ever imagined, right? And so I feel like the same way here is that you have this beginning, which is basically 10 minutes of you're never going to believe this story. And then they tell the story and it actually is legitimately incredible. So
yeah,
I think that's bold.
Yeah, it is. But I do like, so this movie's so influential. You probably read some of this stuff online that like the Rashomon effect.
I've heard of this. Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead. Like in court, when you have multiple witnesses with different stories, that's what it's referring to now.
Wow.
Or it's different perspectives on the same event that are contradictory. That's what they like. This movie is like define that. I think it's hard for us to imagine that now that there would be, because I think we're so into multiple truths now that I think it's hard for us to go back and look what it might have felt like in 1950.
Yeah.
Which of course there were different truth claims, but the idea that one person would take multiple perspectives and try to incorporate that into one event for a film is just, it's like highly philosophical for that time period. It's still highly philosophical now.
And even not to like reveal all at the end, you know, that's what we kind of be used to in like a Matlock type thing. It's like, oh, here's all these different versions, but here's what really happened, right? He doesn't do that. Like the final version you hear still feels like something might be off. And I think that's really ahead of its time.
The characters who were, and the actors that were playing those characters kept asking him what actually happened, and he wouldn't say.
Wow. I love it.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
But I think it is. What I think, so I work with somebody who has a PhD in systematic theology, my friend Desanne, and she loves to talk about essentially contested concepts. So the idea that we might all think we're talking about the same thing, but in reality, we have a different experience of that thing. And so that we actually might have a experience that would be actually not anything like the experience that maybe we assume the other person is talking about.
Is that like the elephant analogy where you're touching one part of it and you're like, that's what an elephant is, but you really only have your experience? Or is that something?
Possibly, or it could be contradictory. So what I think is interesting is to look at, like, you could use Rashomon when you ask the question, who deserves the best picture? Should it be Black Klansman, or is Green Book a better movie?
Yeah.
Well, it's highly dependent on your experience of each movie and your experience that you bring in, and what are your motivations? What are you? What's your what serves you better? Mm-hmm. Like, which one makes you look better? Which one makes you look more defensible? Mm. What narrative can you see yourself fitting into easier? Mm. We tend to do that. So, like, he's like commenting on a lot here.
Yeah,
that would be applicable right now to even to our Academy Award discussion.
Well, it kind of goes back to what is truth mean anyway, right? Because like, is there an objective answer to whether Green Book is a better movie than Black Klansman? Is there like literally like an objective definition? Yes, this is better because of this, this, and this. It really all comes down to perspective, right? In the same way, is there one version of this story? No, it's actually always has to be interpreted by who was there and how it was perceived. So it kind of gets to the meaning of, is there even objective truth? Which,
or meaning. Mm. So in the end, what I find interesting is at the end of this movie, meaning gets reestablished because the priest is like, oh, I've lost my faith in humanity. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he like regains his faith in humanity, but it's still like kind of tenuous, right? He's like, well, I don't know if this is going to stay or not. But for now, it looks like there is good in the world. Even though we saw, like, everyone seems self-serving in this whole narrative.
Yes.
But there is some good in the world.
So, Tim, let me ask you the theological question that Kurosawa asks us. Is there anyone who's really good? Do the Calvinists have it right? Are we all just evil worms to our core? What do you think?
That's like the psalmist's question, right?
Yeah.
Is there anyone good? Is there one? I think that, yeah, this has everything to do with our faith. I think what you see in each character in this movie is that people are self-interested and self-preserving. Like, mm-hmm. That's part of who we are.
Yes.
And instead of trying to deny that, instead of trying to create a heroic figure that is not that, so this is a very different take. What Kurosawa is kind of asserting is like, no, we're all self-serving. Even the most common peasant among us, mm-hmm. who is barely scratching by, can be the most noble. Hmm. But also even the highest samurai lord can be the most base, because we all have a certain level of self-interest.
Yeah.
In that we want to survive. I mean, some basic, it's like a lot of our basic desires are like survival, mm-hmm. That we wouldn't be shamed. All of these things are things that we as human beings want. And that was, in some cases, we'll do anything to keep those things or to gain those things.
Yeah. So sometimes I get really depressed about state of humanity, especially when I watch videos online. And I watched one a few months back about this guy who had, maybe you've seen this, it was like had a bazillion views, but this guy set up these fake Amazon packages where people would steal the package and then it would like blow up in their face when they tried to open it with glitter and like make the scene in their car. Yeah, yeah. And it was, and he planted a camera in it. It's funny, but I actually didn't think it was funny because the most disturbing part of the video is watching these just normal looking people steal this package off his porch. Like that. Yeah. It really starts to shake you. Here's just like this nice looking 45-year-old woman just taking a walk with her dog, and she just runs and grabs a package off someone's porch. Like, what are you doing? And so I just start watching that video and I'm like, wow, maybe everyone is worse than I think they are, like always, right? But then you look at the ending of this movie, which I think is really important, because throughout the film, you have like the worst of us on display. Even the priest doesn't get out of it. He makes this really kind of crude snap judgment at the end. And and he has to get corrected too. And even all the versions of the story just get progressively worse, right? That's what I noticed. You start with like this noble battle between the bandit and the husband, and then you've got the husband just shaming the wife for like getting raped, and then
it's like twisted, yeah.
Right. Then you have the woman that's like, just kill my husband because I want you.
Like just
then,
totally debased. Right. Like everybody is, right?
And then finally at the end,
the bandit at least is like, yeah, I'm totally screwed up and this is how it went down. Yeah.
You know you're bad when the bandit's like, really? Yeah. So just all the versions of the story just keep getting worse. And then you have all these characters that definitely show all the ways they're broken. But then at the end, you have this hope. Like Kurosawa ends the movie on hope. The rain stops. You have a character that takes a completely unselfish action and he walks into the sunlight. And so that kind of gets to my answer to the question. Are we all broken and messed up? Yes. But I believe there's a God who is still working in our hearts and in the world and in every single person. And at the end of the day, we're heading towards something resembling hope, beauty, truth, light, and that's what will win out. So I think it's beautiful.
It's dappled, right?
Yeah.
I think it's like the cinematography is that there's very few moments in that film. I mean, that yes, there's the trial, but there's very few moments in the film where truth is not mixed with darkness. Light 100%. Is not mixed with darkness. Truth is not mixed with lies. Like I think of the wheat and the tares, right? If you want to get rid of the weeds, you're going to get rid of the wheat too. And I think there's something to that. Mm-hmm. There is evil mixed with good.
Yep.
But if we try to root out all the evil, a lot of times we're going to root out the good too.
And make bad movies.
Yeah, oh, so horrible. And so I'd say like the best you can do is try to see the good, be aware of it, right? So it is in some ways like you could connect it to Calvinism in the sense of like we are corrupted to the core.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that there isn't, we can't consider ourselves immune from anything or like having arrived or, but that we do rest in something that's not us.
And I think that is something we may have lost in our rebellion against some of the hardcore fundamentalism is that there actually still is sin inside of all of us. And we need to take that seriously. And we need to not lose our trust that God is still active in the world. It's not all up to us. Thank goodness. And that he ultimately will somehow bring light out of all the darkness. I mean, that's our hope.
Right.
And it's not coming from us.
Yeah. And it may just be that we experience that the light in patches here, not in its fullness. Yes. I think that's also like I think we have this progressive idea that Christians are going to bring, this gets me into like a lot of trouble.
Here we go.
That Christendom is going to arrive. We're going to be the city on a hill. This is so American. And we're going to be the city on the hill and everyone will go, oh, look how they did this grand experiment. They a Christian nation.
Yeah.
But I think the reality that we see is like, no, we're all very corrupt. We're going to experience God in these little flashes. It's not going to be like sun working its way down through a canopy of leaves. And we get little flashes and they'll hit us sometimes. And sometimes we're in darkness. And I think it's like that. I do. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we don't get like a straight sunny day or a dark day. Yeah. It tends to be like a mix. That's more true to life for me, at least. I think it's interesting that last scene, like where it's like totally clear. He was hoping to get more clouds.
Oh, really?
And he couldn't. The weather wasn't cooperating for days.
It was obviously sunny, even in black and white, but he was hoping for a little more of that mix, right?
Yeah. He wanted there to be sun when the woodcutter took the baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then there was, but then he wanted there to be like a cloud without rain, but like that there would be a dark cloud, but wow. The weather didn't cooperate and give him a dark cloud.
Well, it still works throughout the rest of the film. Yeah. It's totally true.
Yeah, but the idea is like beauty and truth and all those things are like just like, they're kind of like, our lives are peppered with them all the time.
All the time.
But there's also darkness all the time. So that seems pretty reasonable.
And any time that we get into the delusion that we are going to have the purified version of ourselves or, like you said, kind of create a country that's like a runway for Jesus' return or something, it's, it's bad news.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can see like, hey, we're all bandits in some way, right? What's the famous line is, oh, it's one bandit talking to another.
Right, right. Yeah. So true.
Which I think is like, that's true, right?
It's totally true.
In some ways, like all of us Christians are like one bandit, you know, mm-hmm. talking to another bandit. Because in some way, we're all trying to defend our ego or our narrative that we want people to believe about us. But that may not, you know, invariably, that just cannot be true. Like mm-hmm. we all are more and less than our version of ourselves.
So, Tim, before we get to our final thoughts, we have to reveal our Oscar tie-in here. What is the significance about Rashomon when it comes to the Oscars?
Okay, so apparently there was some, I don't remember, some official that's supposed to represent Japanese film. Mm-hmm. I don't know, he's Italian or something. So he enters Rashomon into the Venice Film Festival.
Okay.
I'm assuming that's Venice, Italy.
Uh-huh, I'd hope
and
so.
And it wins the Golden... Yeah, no, I was like, Venice Beach? No. And it wins the Golden Lion Award, which is like the best film. Mm-hmm. And what was funny is Kurosawa didn't even know it was entered.
What?
Yes. So takes it, uh-huh. And then it, because it wins that award, it gets starts getting distributed internationally.
Uh-huh.
And subtitled in different languages. And so people begin to get exposed to Japanese cinema. And so Japanese cinema in the 50s and 60s becomes like the thing for like people who are more avant-garde to watch. So the same people that are like wanting to watch Fellini, now they're going to be watching Kurosawa and a whole bunch of other Japanese directors.
Nice.
And post-war Japanese directors that are fairly amazing.
And the Oscars awarded it a honorary foreign language Oscar. This is before there was a category. So that's what happened. It was like this honorary foreign language award. But then 4 years later was the first time that the Oscars actually established an official best foreign film category at the Oscars.
So they didn't have it.
Yeah, now they didn't have it. And there are some people who say that Rashomon started paving the way for that talk of like, we need an actual foreign film award. It can't just be this honorary thing. Like, we need to make it a part of the thing. And Roma won best foreign film. So you could say that if it wasn't for Rashomon, we wouldn't have Roma getting...
We wouldn't have that category even, right?
We wouldn't even have the category. Yeah. Exactly.
I like that special category. In fact, it still exists. They awarded Iñárritu one of those like last year.
Well, what do you mean?
So the special category is like anything that doesn't have a category. So now this film would have won best foreign language film. But prior to that, the Academy, this is something I like about the Academy. Mm-hmm. Is that if something is significant and has added to film or has added to this, you know, cinema in some way that we don't have a category for, but it's so important that we should. Mm. We'll leave an open category. This is why I think this is beautiful. Mm-hmm. We'll leave this open category because maybe if film is changing in significant ways, mm-hmm. possibly we should have an open category because maybe it will change and it will move outside of the category. I'm like, wow, how freaking cool is that? That's like so much better than the Grammys, right?
Totally.
So, and so who gets it? Walt Disney a few times. Mm-hmm. Child actors, when you know, you get like, well, this person, I think they had a category, but it's like people who are like not adults who they want to recognize.
Spike Lee won it before he won an honorary Oscar before he actually won a
for his
Oscar
contribution to film.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I love that category. It's a rough category too, because then like they have to acknowledge that you've done something significant. Mm-hmm. That's outside of the regular categories. Mm-hmm. So that's, but it can become a precursor, like what we see here, a precursor to new categories.
Love it. Yeah. Yes. Good. All right, Tim, go ahead. Final thoughts on Rashomon. And do you think a letter grade is demeaning for a classic like this? Or?
Well, I think that, yeah, I don't think you need to because everyone agrees on this.
Yeah, totally.
Great movie. It's a great entry piece into Kurosawa. It lacks all the action stuff. I mean, there's sword fights and stuff. That's cool. But what I would say is this is a great movie to watch. And then I would recommend that you would watch Hidden Fortress, Yojimbo, and Seven Samurai. But like, if you're like, have never watched Kurosawa, start out with Seven Samurai. It's a long movie. Make a bunch of popcorn. Do it on a rainy day or a snowy day. Mm-hmm. And be prepared to like sit there for a long time and do a lot of reading.
Or if you're like me and that concept turns you off to watching Kurosawa at all, this is a nice 88-minute starter before you get to Seven Samurai. Because it'll make you want to go watch
Hidden Fortress and Yojimbo 2 are good.
Okay.
But yeah, it is. It's 88 minutes. It's pretty tight.
Yeah.
But if you want more action and you want that, like, hey, where did these Clint Eastwood Westerns come from? Mm-hmm. Oh, they're from Japanese samurai films? Weird. You're going to want to watch him. But I would say, like, if you are into film at all, you should probably watch, like, probably 4 or 5 Kurosawa films. Like, get the best ones. And then if you want to get all weird and you watch all of them, go for it.
And they are available on Amazon. So check them out. It's only, like, $2.99 to rent these movies. pittance compared to what you can get out of them. I'm glad that you once again forced me to go back and watch something that was a classic. And I'm really glad I watched this. So thank you. It's just like, it's just so fascinating that a movie all the way back from 1950 contains more honesty and truth than 98% of what we see nowadays. So you got to go back, man. Thank you. All right, there you have it. The movie is Rashomon. I hope you'll check it out. And we will be back next month. Thank you for putting up with a long break. We did not have a podcast in February because it was all things Oscars on the site. So we are committed, Lord willing, going every month now from here on out as we enter into a brand new year, 2019. And hopefully next month we will review our first movie of 2019. And if you have not rated and reviewed us on iTunes, would you please, please, please take 2 minutes to do that for us? It would mean so much to the show. It's the best way to get us in the search results and get those robots turned on, as we like to say. And also tell your friends. Literally, if you love what we do, the best thing you can do is just share with someone you know that loves film or loves Jesus or both, preferably, that, hey, there's this cool podcast. Check it out. So we hope you'll do that.
But and not people that love Jesus films.
Yes, preferably not that. They'll be very disappointed in the kind of films we're covering.
They're not going to like our Mandy coverage. No. Yeah. No, I'd say like that's like help us out a little bit because if you like what you're hearing or if you know some folks that would be like, hey, this is cool, my commute to work or whatever, that'd be fantastic. We'd love to hear from more of you. If you want to write in, yes. we'd love some encouragement. Or if there's a film, like we did an old film that I wanted to do this time. Maybe you have a suggestion of some films mm-hmm. that you're like, how did you guys not do this Godard film? And we're like, okay. Send us what you like. Send us some films that are spiritually significant to you. I mean, like I know some folks that feel like God talks to them in movies. Mm-hmm. Let us know. We can look at some of those films or at least be in dialogue about it on the podcast.
That's right. Our email address, podcast@cinemafaith.com. Again, podcast@cinemafaith.com. Or even if you can't remember that, contact@cinemafaith.com. There's like 8 of them. Anything that would initially come to mind. Just
passenger pigeons. Send us messages. Yes. Morse code.
So drop us an email. We'd love to hear from you. And yes, we will gladly take your film suggestions for the next time we want to go back and watch an older movie. All right, until next month, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.